Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to Caravan to Midnight, Mr. James Perloff. He's been on Caravan many times, but it's been a little bit too long since he's been back. March 14 of 2017. As you may know, he is a prolific writer. He's written The Shadows of Power, Tornado in a Junkyard, The Case Against Darwin, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and The Shadows of Power. It's been around for a long time. And it's an expose of private influence on American foreign policy. Private influence on American foreign policy. Interesting. Sold well over 100,000 copies. And two books about the evidence against Darwin's theory of evolution, including Tornado in a Junkyard. He wrote for the New American Magazine for nearly three decades. Now, he's working on a new book, but his latest book is Truth is a Lonely Warrior. It's a comprehensive look at the satanic drive for world government. And if you're new to Caravan, let me just say welcome. Welcome and bear with us as we will. Well, we're not really bearing with you, but we will. If you're inclined at first to say, really? Satanic influences are going to take over world government. Oh, yes. As I like to say, if you want a new idea, read a really old book. I can suggest one to you. There are several versions of it. King James version is my favorite. But I do like some of the material contained in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Fascinating. And it does make one wonder, now, why'd you decide to include this book but not these other ones? And why did you do this and that? Many of these books weren't discovered when King James put his stamp on it. Hadn't been discovered yet. So anyway, that's a story for another time. I might pick it up with James here in a minute. We might get around to it. But in any case, when we start talking about things like good and evil, the powers of the air, the quest for world domination, these have been ideas entertained by various rulers and emperors, ne'er-do-wells, rogues, rich people, who are absolutely the filthiest forms of flotsam to ever float our way and wind up glomming onto planet Earth. And with that money, they'll claim they're not insane. They really are, but they'll claim that no, it's just the vast amounts of money make everything possible for them. But in the end, if you examine their work closely, if you had to choose between, well, is it a good enterprise or is it an evil enterprise, you're probably going to go with your left hand, the evil enterprise, as opposed to your right. Now, that's just my story, and I'm sticking with it for now. He also wrote the script for Freemind Films documentary Shadow Rings, which came out in 2015. And his website is jamesperloff.com. And we are going to talk about, among other things, Christianity and the truth movement. So why not? James, welcome to Caravan. Been too long, my friend. Good to see you.
Yeah, it has been too long, John. Thank you so much for inviting me back on.
I'm glad you could make the time for it. I saw something today that I found annoying. Can you believe that according to some, the Declaration of Independence is hate speech? Yeah.
Well, you're probably not going to like my response to that, because just yesterday on Dr. Henry Macko's site, he reprinted an article I'd written for him, which is a shortened version of a longer article I did in 2016 called Who Really Wrote the Declaration of Independence? And it was actually not written by Thomas Jefferson. It was written by Thomas Paine. And that's a whole other subject we can go into. Jefferson never claimed authorship until 45 years after the Declaration, 1821, when he was an old man. And the reason that Thomas Paine could not be acknowledged as the author was that Paine, number one, was not an elected delegate to the Continental Congress. Number two, he wasn't an American, and how ironic is that a guy that's not even an American wrote a declaration. And number three, he eventually wrote a book called The Age of Reason, which included blistering attacks on Christianity and blistering attacks on the Bible. And this obviously would have created cognitive dissonance for a lot of Christian Americans. So Thomas Jefferson, by default, who'd been on the drafting committee, he became officially the author. But there have been books going back to the 1800s that have investigated the claim that Paine wrote the Declaration. However, What you read today about the declaration being hate speech may be an entirely different context than what I just said. So why don't you tell me what it was you were reading? But I had to throw that in there because it's such an irony you mentioned it on the same day that I had tweeted out my old article and Henry Mackow had reprinted it.
Well, that's a no. Wait a second, James. Did I miss a question there?
Well, you said that you'd seen something about the declaration being hate speech.
Of course, I'm
well aware that the revolutionary crowd likes to basically bash anything about America.
Oh yeah.
But I actually, in my research into Americans' origins, found a lot of Freemasonic detail there. I grew up in Lexington, Mass, where the shot fired around the world was heard, and I used to walk by the Lexington Battle Green every day. And my son asked me to take him on a tour of the Lexington Concord, where the whole American Revolution began. And as I started to hear the tour guide speaking, they said some things. I said, that didn't sound right. That didn't sound likely that would have happened by chance. And I started to investigate and found that the Battle of Lexington was very much orchestrated to happen the way it did in order to get the revolution going by people who were Freemasons. And I don't doubt that's why the Freemasonic Lodge in Lexington, which is the town where the northern jurisdiction of Freemasonry has its entire headquarters, is in the little town of Lexington where I grew up. I don't doubt that that's where they built their lodge, on the spot where they fired the shot heard around the world. It's possible I'm wrong, but I expect they chose that particular spot for a reason. But in any event, getting back to what you were saying, because it's been an awful long digression on my part. What was it you were reading about the declaration being hate speech?
Well, I'm trying to determine exactly which are the offending quotes. Facebook thought Declaration of Independence quotes were hate speech. CBS has got it, CNN's got it, all the usual suspects. But according to The Vindicator, posted the Declaration of Independence in 12 parts on its Facebook page leading up to the nation's birthday. Even though yesterday we discussed the fact that nothing was actually, it was just accepted on July 4th. It wasn't signed on July 4th. Anyway, The Vindicator posted the Declaration of Independence in 12 parts. And Facebook sends a notice that one of those parts goes against our standards on hate speech.
So, what did they call hate speech? Did they find, was there something specific about it?
Yeah, the full passage of the Declaration of Independence that Facebook deemed a violation. Quote, he has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their own hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So these disgusting, genitally shriveled little weenies at Facebook decide that these passages violate their policy on hate speech. I think they're idiots. Clearly they have no respect. The fact is that is the Declaration of Independence. And so if these people are putting themselves above any document or any pillar of what this nation was built on, which enables them to do these ridiculous things that they do. It's interesting that somehow or another, the people who look over the content to make sure everything meets their standards, apparently teenage girls hanging themselves, and that's the last thing that they ever did. hanged until death, as it might be. That's okay to let that go out on Facebook. And, oh, well, we didn't see it. We left it up there for a few hours with the Declaration of Independence. That's just hate speech. James, you're a very genteel and civilized man, but I got to tell you, just in flat-out English, these people nauseate me. They really do. They're so helpless. What do they think they're protecting everyone from exactly?
Well, I guess they're protecting themselves from things that offend them. And surely there's an agenda there too. Where our history is being part of the plan has always been to change history. It's part of the Orwellian plan to flush it down the memory hole. And despite what I said about the Declaration being written by Thomas Paine and his own anti-Christian views, they would perceive the Declaration as being too American, too nationalist, and therefore not fitting within the scope of their globalist views. And I think he said was there something there about they were quoting about the savages, inciting the savages against us? That might have been. They might have taken that as a racist reference, but
well, savages. Savages still exist. They're over there murdering people every day, selling others into slavery. Other savages brokering the sale.
The thing was that Thomas Paine actually wrote a tract against slavery, and he included a clause against slavery in the original Declaration. You can see that it was crossed out. There were objections to it by slave owners among the signers of the Declaration, but. He would not fall into that category at all. He would be actually, if you look at his remarks upon the Bible, upon Christianity, and upon slavery, he would fit very much into a politically correct mold, but even by liberal standards of today.
Well, look, as I like to say, Thomas Paine, there's a picture of him here. Founding father wasn't just a political revolutionary, but also took a radical approach to religion. His biggest beef was institutionalized religion. I suspect he had a problem with the old C of E, amongst other things. And I think it made him bitter because his analysis of the book of Genesis is hardly complimentary. It's just an assembly of fables and outright lies. So, but here's the other part.
Right, that's about how he put it, yeah.
He's not Jesus. So you can't believe nor join with everything that he says. He did his bit. Fine, if he wants to take that view. It's really not our problem. But our problem in this permissive society, that permissive in that it will allow everything, gay men and women, gay couples to be married in church, gay ministers, gay parades. The more naked gay people in the gay parade, the more prideful they are, the more media coverage they get, the more attention they garner. They're okay with all of that. They're completely okay with all sorts of things that I just never considered normal. And it's not because I was raised in a household of racists. We didn't hear, I may have heard my entire life up to age 21. I might have heard the so-called N-word a total of maybe 6 or 8 times in those years. And it was usually just somebody trying to be funny, or it was another black person, which made the white people go, well, how are we supposed, I'm not really sure how to react to that. In fact, I think I said that to him. Oh, no, man. And then came the complicated handshake. We all good. We cool. It's like, okay, good. What were we talking about before you said that and warped everybody's minds? Anyway, Christianity and the truth movement and the New World Order. Well, the New World Order, we pretty much have that peg. So where Christianity and the truth movement are concerned, are they in harmony with each other or not?
Yeah, this is a post I wrote about. It's a relatively short post I wrote back in February. They've been on my mind for a while. And I wondered why we didn't have a greater harmony between Christianity and the truth movement. I noticed that there was some hostility among some truthers towards Christianity. There's a great variableness amongst truthers. You know, you have, I'd say the majority are Christian. You also have, of course, some coming from a Muslim background, some who are New Agers, and some I found who are really just outright hostile to Christianity. And at the same time, you know, Jesus Christ said, I came to tell you the truth 78 times. We know that God would be a God of both love and truth, and being a respecter of truth, one would think that more Christians would be involved with the truth movement, but unfortunately, you know, most of them, like we were at one time in our lives, are thoroughly matrixed. But one would hope that there would be more Christians who would embrace Christianity, and at the same time, there would be more truthers who would start to look at the spiritual dimensions behind the New World Order that they're confronting. And, you know, the way I actually started out early in this article was recalling my own past when I was a hippie. Now, we're going back 48 years in time. But when I was a hippie, we had some awareness that there was what we call today the powers that be. You know, we understood that there were some rich dudes running the country, but our understanding was not deep. You know, we said, you called it the establishment. Maybe a few people called it the man back then. Can't quite remember if that term was in vogue. But we did not know the history of false flags. We didn't know about the Council on Foreign Relations. We didn't know a thing about the Federal Reserve. We really were greatly ignorant of the true nature of the New World Order. And our perspective on these guys was pretty much a Marxist perspective. It was, there was no spiritual element. We said, you know, these guys, we saw these guys as rich guys who are trying to get richer. In other words, there's a wealthy elite, the establishment, they've got a lot of money, and what they're trying to do is exploit the poor in order to get more money. And that was the Marxist point of view, you know, when Marxism excludes spirituality. But what's happened is with the internet and this incredible acceleration of information is that it's become very clear that the New World Order is not just about money. It's certainly true that they use money to motivate people, that the, you know, the bankers get huge bonuses and salaries, and newscasters get six-digit salaries, at least maybe seven, I don't know. But what's really motivating these people, we've begun to see the Luciferian side of it. And so, you know, if you go back in time, this is actually not something new. You know, I've now one of my favorite authors historically is William Guy Carr. He wrote a book called Pawns in the Game, which I really consider one of the best books about the New World Order, written in the 50s. I'm amazed. He was a Canadian intelligence commander, Carr, but I'm amazed at the reach he had. You know, he actually listed the Bilderberger attendees in 1957. I mean, how many people were doing that in 57? He showed the list at Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller. Right? 1957, he was talking about this stuff. He was amazing, but he understood the spirit. He said these people are worshipers of Satan. And actually, the last book he wrote before he died, rather prematurely, was called Satan, Prince of This World. And then it's kind of interesting, the late Ted Gunderson, who had been the special agent in charge of the Los Angeles branch of the FBI, with 700 FBI personnel under him, talked about the Satanism of the power elite. And he specifically referenced William Guy Carr and said that his works had been confirmed. And, you know, a few years ago, probably about 15 years ago, I started reading some of John Coleman's work. He said he was in MI6. And he talked about how these people were worshippers of Satan. And now, I don't know if you've seen these, John. You probably have, or I imagine a lot of your listeners have, the interviews with this Dutch currency manipulator named Ronald Bernard, where he talks, it's in Dutch, but it's translated or has subtitles. And he talks about how he was, you know, he said there's 8,000 people that run the world. He was close to these people. He was carrying on these currency manipulations for them. And they took him to the Church of Satan. And he said he kind of laughed it off. But he said what really shook him up and what got him to leave what he was doing was when they asked him to engage in child ritual sacrifice. And when you see his expression on his face, you know he's telling the truth. He said he'd had a very harsh childhood. It was something that he could not confront or even think about. And so this is further confirmation. We also see it in other ways. You know, we see it, of course, in Hollywood. We see it in, you know, the Baphomet statue being revealed. We see there's a TV show now on Fox called Lucifer, where Lucifer's a good guy. And there's a book that came out recently by Tex Mars called Hell's Mirror. He's got a lot of photos there where architecture around the world is being built with satanic symbolism on it. And as if they were preparing the world for the arrival of the Antichrist. And you look at television, you look at Madonna dressing up as Baphomet and kitty shows with a Baphomet-like figure. And you realize that these people are serious about it. And so even if a particular truther might view the world as materialistic himself, the fact of the matter is that the powers that be really aren't atheists. Getting rid of God, I've written two books on Darwinism, and you know the reason they backed Darwinism was to make people think there's no such thing as God, because they wanted people to forget about the Ten Commandments. Because you know what? If you make people think that God and the Ten Commandments are just an old myth, then it's a lot easier to get newscasters and politicians to lie for you and soldiers to kill for you and bankers to rob for you if you take those away. But they themselves, not unlike Big Brother, where, you know, Big Brother, everybody said, I love Big Brother. We are coming to a point, I believe, where there will be some sort of satanic figure who wants to be worshipped, not unlike Orwell's Big Brother. But the point being that this is not just a money-driven system. They use money to motivate people who work for them. But at the root of it, it is Luciferian. And one would hope that truthers, as they see this, because I know that there's some truth that is still kind of stuck in that hippie mode, that this is just about money and power. It's deeper than that. We are looking at spiritual warfare being played out in the geopolitical arena.
Well, I'm with you on that. That's why that's why I threw in the part about people will say, who have that level of money, if you push them and suggest that what they're doing is insane, they'll tell you they're not insane. Mm-hmm. It's just fantastically large amounts of money make everything possible. The fact is they are insane. Mm-hmm. Evil is insane.
Right.
Recently, I was speaking with, I can't remember at this moment, talking about the sacrificial tables and so forth. I think it was L.A. Marzulli, I think. And I thought, sacrificial tables, we'll make a special table to put the human on. And then while they're alive, you know, they'll do what the Aztecs did. They found bones down there. I mean, they were, for some reason, the savages, to use that horrible, illegitimate word, really enjoyed removing the entrails of their sacrificial victims. It was either the heart, the Aztecs were into that, but there was also, there's something about the bowel that really fascinates them. And you think to yourself, seriously, of course the English were into it too back in the old days. They had those torture chambers. They would occasionally cut up some maiden that they turned everybody on a little bit too much. They went, she's evil. So then those perverts got off by killing her. So this has been going on for a long time. You are entirely correct. It's not that they're after money. It's that the money is the lubricant for the machine. Right?
That's correct. Superficially, we might see the money and think that that's the driving force, but ultimately, it is a spiritual battle. And, you know, I did, by the way, you were mentioning about the sacrificial tables. One other item I should just mention, of course, is the whole thing with John Podesta and the spirit cooking. That's another one. It's just another affirmation of the fact that this is a Luciferian deal. And sure, Hillary Clinton wants money, but there's being materialistic, certainly it goes along with this. But it is definitely a spiritual, the nature of the battle is a spiritual one. And there are also reasons why, of course, the people who reject Christianity who are in the truth movement, I think that has a lot to do with the way Christianity has eroded over the course of two centuries. But that might be getting a little ahead of schedule on what we're discussing.
Well, James, let me ask you this. A lot of people think that the church as a whole, not each and every church, but the church with all capital letters, has really let the people down because of all this permissiveness on the one hand, and really the failure to teach the gospel, just teach from the Bible. You wind up in a lot of cases getting, Joe's interpretation, or Bill's or Bob's interpretation. No offense to any Joe's, Bill's, or Bob's out there. I could say Bob's interpretation too.
You're right. Yeah. Church services have come down in many cases to the pastor's opinions in a sermon. And that's not the way the church originally was. If there was a sermon, it was, it didn't go far off the beaten path for one thing. And it didn't get that much into opinion. We've seen, Christianity take many twists and turns, but you know, I took one time a couple of truther friends to a church I was attending. This is a few years back, and because I wanted these people to, I felt it'd be good if they had a more spiritual dimension. But the pastor of this church, which is very Zionized, was very pro-war and was talking about America's wars being fought for our freedoms and liberties. And very pro-Israel, and I don't know where you stand on Israel, John. I'm half Jewish myself, but I'm well aware that Israel is was not only heavily connected to 9/11 and has been the sole beneficiary of that event, but is engaged in terror events, the attack on the USS Liberty, the Levant affair, the LaBelle Disco, the King David Hotel bombing. It goes back a long ways. But when truth is going to a church like that and they see that the pastor is not connected to reality geopolitically, then they're going to say, well, how can I trust this guy to show me more important things about God and eternal life? And so part of the problem, sure, it might be the truth movement needing to more recognize the fact that this is a Luciferian enemy we're dealing with. But part of the problem is what's happened in the churches themselves. There are actually three branches of Christianity that people think they have, and all of them are in one way or another repugnant, and that is by design. And that's why I recently embraced a fourth Christian option myself, which I have a blog post about.
The way things are interpreted incorrectly these days. I thought it was just me. I'm not sure. I'm going to try it out on you. When you first heard the educational initiative put forward by, I believe, the Bush administration, Bush himself, No Child Left Behind.
Sounds good.
What did you think that meant?
Well, it sounds as if superficially, it sounds like it's somebody who really cares about children and doesn't want anyone to be neglected in itself. But, there's a lot of Madison Avenue type slogans that the government has about freedom, liberty, and democracy, which actually don't, in reality, those are just cliches and slogans. They don't reflect the reality of American policy.
Yeah, well, I thought that it meant we're going to make sure these kids are educated. We're going to allocate money for additional teachers and remedial money for people that are behind and you get caught up. But no, it just means that whether they can read or write, we're going to graduate them to the next grade.
Yeah, that's a good way to keep people dumbed down.
Oh, isn't it? And now we have a generation of people who have come up, they bless them. They could know, but they don't because they haven't been taught. If they're not taught, how can they know? They can't, unless it's divinely inspired. It happens, but it's not happening in a manner widespread enough for my tastes. It's, in the same way, the preachers are doing this with the Bible. That little passage, love thy neighbor as you love yourself. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. You know, show them some love. You're already showing yourself a lot of love. Show them some love. Mm-hmm. No, it means love yourself also. Don't forget to love yourself. If you can't love yourself, why is that? You need to look at that. But they're not teaching it that way. They're not even asking the question, what is meant by this? Love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, I don't know, Pastor. It sounds like we're already eaten up with self-love. We should share.
Right. Mm-hmm. Definitely. That was certainly the intent. Yeah.
But that's not it, lad. What it means is don't leave yourself out of the love.
I hadn't heard that particular interpretation of that particular verse before.
You haven't?
It depends on which church you're going to and which pastor you're listening to. But I'm not surprised that someone would come up with that.
Well, I did. And what do you mean, which part? The part about loving yourself?
Loving yourself, yeah. Jesus obviously intent was that you already love yourself. Love your neighbor as well. And that's something we all need to upgrade because we are inherently, by our nature, selfish. I plead guilty to that. But obviously, there's no question that Jesus was not saying you need to put more attention on number one, on yourself. No question, he was not talking about that.
You know, James, normally, whenever a guest comes onto the program, they'll have a, not always, but usually there will be a few points that they've set out that they want to cover, and that's fine. And we can talk about all those things. It's just a little reminder list of things not to leave out. But when you and I get together, we've talked together enough that we can have a conversation on a number of subjects, and it'll be just fine. So let me pull one out of left field. Leftist, get it?
Okay.
Is the Christian component necessary in a social truth movement, in your opinion?
Well, I think it is to the degree that we need, I think that anybody in their life needs some kind of spiritual foundation. You know, a lot of people have commented to me, how can someone look at how evil the world is becoming? And if you believe that there's only a material dimension to the world, wouldn't that be very depressing not to have some sort of afterlife or some type of reward for good works? Otherwise, why not just eat, drink, and be merry? Why not just give it the New World Order, become part of it, and work for them? In fact, I've heard of people who have said that, you know, hey, I want to join this New World Order. It sounds pretty good. You know, these guys get all kinds of great perks. To be sure, we'll go ahead, John. Go ahead.
I just wondered, look, this has been kind of a strange day. For example, it doesn't really have to be a big show with fireworks to get my attention. Sometimes it's just something that somebody says casually that is really more revealing than the rest of the interview that I heard being conducted. But Rush Limbaugh himself said, he was talking with a fellow about these chemical trails in the sky. And he said, yes, he's heard about this for years. And he's heard the references to from people in government, even. They're saying, yeah, that's the idea is to create clouds and shade the earth from all this outrageous sunlight. So I thought, all right, that's the first time I've heard him touch a subject that would be clept under the title of under the file name of conspiracy theories.
Right.
But he went on to say that, just by the way, that in 1911, there was a terrible heat wave in the Northeast, and 2,000 people died. It was ridiculous. Railroad tracks were warping, and a sports team was on its way to compete with another baseball team, and they were on a train that actually derailed because it was so hot that people were drowning from jumping in rivers, and this train was derailed because the tracks warped and ran right off the tracks. And he said, it's not that the weather is getting crazy. It's always been crazy. The crazy comes and goes. And I thought, all right, that's true. That's as close as we're going to get to hearing him say, all weather is controlled by unequal heating of the Earth's surface, period. And so he went on to say that there's always some mad scientist that thinks that they can control the weather, and they can to a degree, but they really can't. I don't know why I felt his even discussing this with a caller at the length that he took to discuss it with me. It was important in some way, but I think that it is. It's almost as though these things that we've talked about on alternative news programs and channels like this one and others, they're creeping into the mainstream. It's taking way too long for them to creep into the mainstream, but they are creeping in. Nobody wanted to hear about Israel's culpability, but look, another little deal, going back to what you said about Israel being involved in 9/11, of course they were. Israel, the Saudis were also involved, right? And who did we just hear being buddy-buddy recently as they're preparing to square off against Iran? Why Saudi Arabia and Israel? So if they worked together before, why wouldn't they work together again if it was successful? And
certainly.
It was. We've been in the Middle East for 15 years, so I guess it worked out pretty well for somebody.
Well, they both have a great relationship with the United States, and ISIS doesn't attack either one of them. And in fact, ISIS is supported by both of them. So you're right, they're working for a similar, not necessarily identical, but similar agendas. No doubt about that.
It's like Voltaire said, if you want to know who your rulers are, determine which one it is you cannot criticize. And in the case of who do we think is really behind this, it's like, well, look at who's not being attacked after the show gets started. Mm. And then you'll know who some of the players are, the ones who aren't being attacked. You just said it. Take us somewhere else, Big Daddy. Where else? What else do you want to hit? What are some of the brighter blips on your scope?
Well, just to complete that conversation about Christian and the Truth Movement, I feel that one reason that there isn't a greater nexus between truthers and Christianity is that Christianity has been degraded over the last two millennia, especially in here in the West. And I'll just mention, I'm not a theologian, and I'm certainly not a spokesperson for the institution I'm about to mention, but last November I became a member of the Orthodox faith, the Eastern Orthodox faith. And just to give a little history on this, John, for the first 1,000 years after Christ, there was basically just one church. And it wasn't until the year 1054 that the church split in two. And that happened for more than one reason, but the most essential reason, I think it's fair to say, is that the Pope wanted to become the sole arbiter of what the church did in terms of its policies. Up until that time, that had not been the case. The church had always met at what they called ecumenical councils. There were seven convened over the centuries. And you'd have patriarchs from all over Christendom come. And the Patriarch of Rome was given the highest seat of honor, similar to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But he didn't have the only vote. It was by a unanimous vote that issues were decided, that heresies were decided upon. That split in a way led to a situation where in the West, the only exposure we had to Christianity was through the Vatican. The East had been excommunicated by the Vatican, and we forgot that they existed, more or less. They were headquartered in Constantinople. And then after Constantinople was conquered by the Turks in 1453, Moscow became, for all practical purposes, the center of Christianity. It had the entire nation of Russia had converted to Eastern Orthodoxy in the year 988. Not to bore people with a lot of history, but in the West, the Vatican continued to degrade in certain ways, such as the selling of indulgences, which led to Martin Luther splitting away from the Catholic Church. And he had very valid reasons for his disagreement with the Vatican. But the problem is when he split away, everybody decided to split away. And so King Henry VIII started the Anglican Church because he couldn't get a divorce from the Pope, which wasn't a particularly good reason to start your own church. And then as churches began to fragment and split, we had dozens and then hundreds and finally thousands of denominations. Denominations would spin off from one another, and you couldn't recognize the church anymore because elder boards and pastors would decide, this is how we're going to worship. We'll do it this way. We'll be secret sensitive. We'll introduce rock and roll, blah, blah, blah. You know, and but the Eastern Orthodox Church, and I discovered this after, you know, after being in evangelical churches for over 30 years, and this is not to in any way degrade anybody's experience in these churches, because I had valid encounters with God in these churches, and other people have had as well. It's not to in any way degrade people's encounter or the degree of their faith they have or in these churches. What I found is that the Eastern Orthodox Church, it has maintained the same form of worship from the fourth century. So if you walk into an Eastern Orthodox church, you're seeing the same form of worship from the fourth century. In the fourth century, that's when Constantine legalized the church. That's when the first council, the Council of Nicaea, was held in the year 325. And so that's one of several features about the church that attracted me. But in the West, people think they have a choice either between the Vatican, which even the most traditional Catholics acknowledge has been degraded, especially since what they called Vatican II in the 1960s, or modernist churches, which have been degraded in their belief in the Bible, in their belief in the fundamentals of the faith. And that was all financed by the Rockefellers. I wrote an extensive article on my website, jamespolis.com. It's called The War on Christianity, Part 1, How the Rockefellers Infiltrated the Churches. And let me give an example of this. Okay, in 1922, there was a pastor named Harry Emerson Fosdick. He was a graduate of Union Theological Seminary, which had been funded by the Rockefellers. And he gave a sermon in which he denounced all the fundamentals of the faith, the virgin birth, the miracles, Christ dying in atonement for our faith. Well, he was tried for heresy. He was expelled by his church. But guess who hired him as pastor of his church right after that?
Oh, I give up already.
John D. Rockefeller. Part of his pastor wow. of Riverside Church, which John D. had built for $4 million, which is a lot of money back in the 19th that time. And Harry Emerson Fosdick's brother was the president of the Rockefeller Foundation for 12 years. And John D. took that controversial sermon and printed 130,000 copies and had it distributed to Protestant pastors across America. The Rockefellers were knee deep in degrading the Christian faith, in taking away all the beliefs in the Bible as the Word of God, the miracles, the resurrection, the virgin birth, Christ's second coming, and getting pastors trained at seminaries who teach these things. They were opposed by the fundamentalists. I attended fundamentalist churches for over 30 years who do believe that the Bible is the Word of God, who do believe in the miracles. But their problem is, and it took me a long time to figure this out, is that they were backed by the Rothschilds. No, the Rothschilds had to always play both sides of a war. They backed the fundamentalists in the war against the modernists. And they did that through something called the Scofield Reference Bible, which was published in 1917, the same year as the Balfour Declaration. The Scofield Reference Bible was used the King James Bible, but its notes, which were right in the same pages as the verses of the Bible, were designed to reinterpret the Bible to convince Christians that they had to get behind the State of Israel. And the Zionist movement, which had been started in 1897 by Theodore Herzl with Rothschild backing. And so that's why when you go into these churches, as I brought my truther friends in, they would see the pastor preaching pro-war. And those ministers have been convinced to support our wars, that they're somehow these wars for the behalf of, which are really on behalf of Israel, are to defend American liberty, freedom, and democracy. And so you have a choice between a corrupted Vatican, a modernized mainstream Protestant church, or a Zionized fundamentalist church. And all three are not really in accord with the church. And so that's how, in desperation, after many years in these churches, I actually myself found myself turning to the same church that Hank Hanegraaff has now turned to, that Brother Nathaniel found, and that many other Christians are waking up to, and that's the Orthodox Church, which has not given over to corruption, which has not given over to Christian Zionism or to modernism, and still worships the way Christians did 16 centuries ago. I'm sorry about the long speech, and it's not meant to be an advertisement for Orthodoxy. Again, I'm not a spokesman for the Church. I'm what you might call a novice to Orthodoxy, but that's kind of my own spiritual journey, and I also comment on what's happening in our own churches, and why we don't have more harmony and more people coming into the churches, because they don't find a lot of truth in the Western churches these days.
Now, when you say Eastern Orthodox, mm-hmm. so if someone was, I've heard people say the Russian Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. Is that the Eastern Orthodox Church?
It is, but in the case of the Orthodox Church, they have the Greek Orthodox Church, the Syrian Orthodox Church, the Antiochian Orthodox Church. It depends on which country they came from. Each country has its own Orthodox Church, which has its own language, but the ceremony is the same. It still goes back to that same liturgy from the 4th century, and they have their own hierarchy, but there really is very little in the way of disagreement between these churches. They maintain the basic unity of the faith, and it's the best, I believe, personally, that it's the best reflection of the way Christianity was intended to be. And that doesn't mean we can't go on to other subjects, but I just felt I had to complete that thought about Christianity and the truth movement and why they aren't closer together. I think part of the problem is truth is needing to recognize this Luciferian element to the leaders of the New World Order, but it's also hard for them to go into the Christian church because they hear a lot of things that aren't true in those churches. They see corruption, they see modernism, and they see support for American wars from the fundamentalists, which they know are not justified. And so it's very hard for them to join those congregations, and they want to feel that they want to be part of it. So I think that a lot of the division between the church, which there really shouldn't be, again, Jesus said 78 times, I come to tell you the truth. There should be this synonymy. There should be harmony between the truth movement and Christianity, which we don't see today. But it's an issue that's is complex because it's developed over the course of 2 centuries.
Well, if look, I don't know that much about the Eastern Orthodox Church, but the Orthodox Church itself doesn't really, this writer claims that it does not speak with a clear message that can be harmonized with the biblical gospel of Christ. The call of reformers for scripture alone, faith alone, grace alone, and Christ alone is missing in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And that is too precious a treasure to do without. That's one writer's opinion. It seems really unnecessarily complicated. What's really interesting is that among the Christian churches, there are arguments as to the way one should pursue an understanding of faith and to secure one's faith and maintain it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it's not just one book, it's not just one interpretation. You got a bunch of people out there freelancing with it, and you see absolutely everything under the sun with the name church after it.
Right, and that's just the point I was making, was that the Orthodox Church still maintains the same way of worship that Christians had 16 centuries ago, and that's really when Christianity came out from the catacombs, when they were legalized, when they were no longer being persecuted, and this is how they worship. This is how, you know, it was the Council of Nicaea that gave us the Nicene Creed, and, you know, it was those Christians that validated what the books of the Bible were, and if we can trust them to tell us what the Bible should be, why can't we trust them to tell us how to worship at the same time, you know? And by the way, the Orthodox form of worship is filled with Bible. It's filled with Bible verses. You'll be hard-pressed to find something in there that is not out of the Bible. These guys knew what they were doing. And what I like about, I have to tell you this, you know, what I like about liturgy, it isn't necessarily exactly the same from week to week because they'll have a hymn that they didn't seek the week before. They'll be honoring somebody they didn't honor the week before. But basically, the liturgy, which has the communion as its centerpiece, is the same. What I like about that, John, is that it maintains the stability of worship over all these centuries, and it doesn't allow people to go their own route. There's a danger to that. I mean, I like creativity. I'm a creative. I try to be a creative person, and God is obviously a creative spirit. But the problem is that when people decide how they want to worship, they change the way Christianity has been done, and then somebody else comes along within that church and they form a splinter group because they don't like the way the pastor is doing something. And all of a sudden, you're walking into churches, you really don't know what the true form of Christianity is. I believe that the Orthodox Church actually is the best representation of that, because they have firmly held to the roots of the fourth century when Christianity was legalized and was allowed to come out into worship. So that's kind of my story. I probably better not spend too much time on this. I don't want people to think that this is just a boring theological interview, but that's kind of where I'm at right now. And, but it's also comment on the kind of what Christianity we have in the West and why we don't see this greater congruity between truthers and Christianity that I would like to see. I would like to see Christian pastors coming out, talking about 9/11 truth, talking about the invalidity of our wars, instead of thinking they have to be, that somehow it's patriotic to support these wars overseas, when none of these countries, whether we're talking about Libya or Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or Yemen, they've never attacked us. That's not the purpose of our military, is to go across and kick ass of other nations and defend their own country. These countries have not attacked us. And if the preacher is preaching for the pulpit that these wars are good, to tell you the truth, it's not just that he's wrong. He's actually preaching something that's Luciferian, in my opinion, from the pulpit of God. And that's one of the things that really, I reached a point, John, where I couldn't take another day in this kind of church. I reached a point where I said, you know, I have to get out. And I felt very blessed to find Orthodoxy. But then let's move on, unless you want to bank off of something that I've said.
Look, it's completely cool. And we talk about all kinds of things here. So to use that time-worn and quite honored word, it's cool. It's completely cool.
Thank you.
I think, for example, I believe what you're saying is that they have maintained their tradition since the fourth century.
Correct.
They have not modified it. They have not, shall we say, tarted it up, made it more appealing, more modern. They've straight down the barrel. This is it. Which is why some people will write an article like that one, which suggests, if it doesn't blatantly state, and actually it did, that, well, as far as the Eastern Orthodox Church is concerned, their traditions is weigh just as much as the Bible, the gospel. It's like, I don't think that's what they're saying at all, but that's what the man wrote. Now that he's written it, someone out there has read it, as I have, and they're thinking, what about this Eastern Orthodox Church? So if it did anything, if anybody's interested at all, they won't just go and move on. They'll go, and wait a minute.
Yeah, well, let me just explain that the Orthodox Church, it regards the scripture, the Bible, as absolutely senior, but it also attaches value to tradition. And I'll give you an example. You know, the Bible is basically written in the first century. And as the churches were developed, questions arose about things like infant baptism. Questions arose, how do you do confession? Now, you know, one of the things that the Bible tells us to do is to confess our sins. And yet I've never been to a Protestant church where that happened. And, you know, of course, in the Orthodox Church, as well as the Catholic Church, people confess their sins on a regular basis to a priest who's sworn to confidentiality. But, in the West, Western Christianity, we can't find a biblical basis for that. And so we don't do it at all. We can't figure out how to do it because, you know, if you confess your sins through your Bible study, maybe there's a gossip there. Maybe you confess that you've been flirting with your secretary at work. Now the gospel goes to your wife and tells the whole story. And so your confession has not relieved your guilt. It's actually exacerbated it. It's ruined your relationship with your wife. So the church figured out, and this is after the time that the Bible was being written, the best way to handle this was to confess your sins to the priest who was sworn to confidentiality. But because it's not in the Bible, people say, well, it's a tradition. We should ignore it. The Eastern Orthodox Church is saying, yeah, the Bible is highest, but there's also traditions that were developed in the early years that we need, that had wisdom that we need to pay attention to. And so that's the distinction there. It's not that they're saying we respect tradition, not the Bible. We do hold the Bible in reverence and above the tradition, but the tradition also has wisdom for us to learn from, and that we maintain a lifestyle that is integrated with. So I like it. You know, I like it. I like that the wisdom, I've recently been reading the works of the early church fathers, people like St. Ignatius, the Bishop of Antioch, and St. Justin Martyr, who lived from 100 to 165 AD. These men had great wisdom to share with us. And I knew a lot of modern Christians who were familiar with modern Christian writers, but none of them, I shouldn't say none, but most of them had not read the early church fathers. And you know, there's a lot you can learn by going back in time and seeing how the church developed. I've heard people say that there's no basis for bishops and priests. But actually, if you go back in time, you'll find that James, the author of the Epistle of James, he was the first bishop of Jerusalem. You go back to Eusebius, which I recently finished reading. He's got the whole history of the church laid out. He lists all the early bishops. He lists the first 15 bishops of Jerusalem, and the first was the Apostle James. It was, you know, it was a tradition that was there, and if we ignore it, we lose a lot. We lose a lot of information, and it's almost as if our church history begins with Martin Luther, and we've got this gap between the Bible and Martin Luther, and we've lost a lot by ignoring it. There's a gap that gets filled in through the Orthodox faith.
You know, let me just run this past you.
Sure.
So you said, and folks, listen, I mean this now. Now I mean this. It's we're talking about. I mean the broad title of our discussion is Christianity and the Truth Movement.
Mm-hmm. Which I hope we haven't strayed too far. Yeah.
Sorry. Say that again.
I hope we haven't strayed too far. If it is, it's my
fault. No, yeah. We haven't, and that's really what I was getting at. The thing is this isn't just a subject that you can discuss bullet point by bullet point. That's soundbite news that you get on network television. But we are actually working our way. Well, we are. We're working our way into it, because what you just said was it was determined that the best way to confess your sins was to a priest who was effectively sworn to confidentiality and secrecy, and everybody confirmed in their own minds and amongst themselves that this priest has integrity and we can trust him, so let's roll with it. Let's have faith that this man of God is capable of hearing all of the rubbish that we have to tell him, and he'll keep it quiet. Okay, that's fine. What I'm thinking, and it's just me thinking again, I'm not Jesus either. You can't believe everything that I say. I think what Scripture is trying to communicate to the reader or the hearer, if somebody else is reading and the hearer can't read, so he's relying on this one to read accurately, please, and repeat, do not add nor take away. There's always that component too. Now, some people out there may at this moment be going, oh, come on. It's like, no. This is how things get screwed up on a spectacular level. Little stuff. Always remember causes are smaller than their effects almost every time. We're talking about a BB down the carburetor. Now it's jammed a valve. Now the valves come loose. Now the piston comes up and hits the valve. Now the engine has stopped and you're looking at about a $3,000 bill, and that was 20 years ago. So that's what I'm talking about. Causes, the little cause and the huge effect. With this, James, I'm thinking that what is meant to be communicated at this moment from the Scripture is that confess your sins in your prayer. Go back over this and remember piece by piece in a linear manner what it is that you did that's causing your conscience and your heartache. Once you have confessed, doesn't say go confess to the priest and then the two of you will take it up with God the Father. Doesn't say that at all. Just confess your sins, meaning admit what you did, because many people will not. You stole. I didn't either. Yes, you did. No. Well, look, I put in all these hours, and I did this, and I did that, and really, when you think about it, I was told that I would get a commission, so when I paid myself that commission, I was merely paying myself. It's like, no, you stole, and now you're lying about it. They don't mean to steal or lie. They just did. Technically, they did, just like General Flynn right now, for example. Mm-hmm. If he did lie to the FBI, he didn't know he was lying to them. He didn't have the information organized. He wasn't ready for that question. So the answer he gave, that doesn't line up with what we have. It's like, well, I don't really know what you have. And if I did, it would make me remember something else. But to the best of my knowledge, it's like this, like, no, you're lying. And he's not lying. So isn't the Bible really about finding your faith in your Creator and salvation through his Son?
Yes.
And between you and your Creator. It's not between you and the other people. Spread the good news, spread the good word. But it's not a club. It's between you and God.
Well, I think it's also community because, the Bible says to confess sins to each other. It doesn't say just to confess them to God. And I personally found when you confess your sins before another person, it's quite different. I mean, it's easy to confess something you've done you're embarrassed about privately, and whisper or just say it in your mind. But when you confess it before another person, one of the values of that, John, is that for me personally, I feel that you're less likely to commit. I'm less likely to commit a sin if I know I'm going to confess the thing later. Not that you'll be forced, but on a rack or something like that, But if you're going to confess it later, you probably think twice about it. So there was value, and one of the things about the Orthodox faith is, and again, I'm not a spokesman at all for the Orthodox faith. I'm just speaking my own. Again, I'm a newbie. Is that a lot of people will condemn the Orthodox faith because it has certain traditions, and Jesus, condemned the traditions of the Pharisees. I just want to put it in context. He condemned the traditions of the Pharisees. Those traditions were what they call the oral law, which was negating the laws of God, and that became the Talmud, written down as the Talmud, and that is actually very different. He wasn't saying ignore all the traditions of the Christian church itself. It's a different ballgame.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. As these understandings kind of fall apart, you practically have to hire a worldwide staff, to maintain things so that those misunderstandings don't occur, and worse, don't occur if possible. But when they do, that they don't get much traction, and a particular mindset or interpretation doesn't spread, that the priests in the know who have spent their lives studying this are going to say this is wrong. That this is if this gets any more momentum, we've got a problem because we're going in a direction that we shouldn't go. It's taking on a life of its own.
And that's why they had these ecumenical councils where they would call hundreds of bishops and priests together during the first millennium of Christianity, where they decide these things. At the Council of Nicaea, for example, there was one heresy that had developed in Alexandria called Arianism, which basically said Jesus was not really divine, did not have a divine nature, and I'm oversimplifying. But it was only a few people who believed that. When they called together all the priests and bishops, it was ruled out. I mean, because they'd been taught by the original apostles who'd spread the gospel all the way from, basically from Europe to Asia, India, Africa. That's how they decided things, was through these ecumenical councils, so that these little heresies and mistakes cannot be spread. There's something else I wanted to say about Christianity and the Truth Movement, if I could mention it, which is that it's the whole issue of persecution. If you look back, the worst persecutions in history have probably been persecutions of the Christians. The Bolsheviks wiping out 60 million in Russia, who were basically all Christians, and they actually murdered 300,000 priests under Lenin and Trotsky alone, and they destroyed 60,000 churches. And if you look at the Armenian genocide, the Ukrainian genocide, we're talking Christians, not to deny the genocides of other non-Christian populations.
Those like are definitely, the Jews and the 6 million. I heard 3 million when I was a kid. Then I heard 4. Then it went to 6. And somebody tried to take it to 8. And another Jewish guy in that meeting that was being televised said, no, it wasn't 8. We're going to leave it at 6. It was really funny. But it was a lot.
A whole different topic to address, but what I wanted to mention was that remember when you dropped the A-bomb in Japan? We hit Nagasaki.
Yeah.
The only book I've ever reviewed on my website, because I was so impressed by it with it, was called Atomic Bomb Secrets by David Dionisi. And one of the main things he pointed out, his book was about Nagasaki. Nagasaki was the center of Christianity in Japan. There were more than 50,000 Christians there, and they got wiped out because our Luciferian powers that be, when Japan, they knew they were going to make the Japanese emperor renounce his divinity. They didn't want Christianity to move in and fill the void. That's why Nagasaki was targeted. It was specifically for that reason. In fact, the bomb, what they call the Fat Man bomb that detonated over Nagasaki, you know what Ground Zero was, John? It was Urakami Cathedral, which is the largest Christian cathedral in all of Asia.
Not a coincidence. James, wait a minute, brother. How do you know this? Because that's some strong stuff, pal.
Well, you can see the picture of Urakami Cathedral, pictures of it before and after the atomic bomb.
So if somebody says, James, can you prove this? You can say, yes, I can prove it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can see the cathedral, and the Americans acknowledged that was Ground Zero. Truman said a mistake, it was really a military target, but by some off chance, the plane overthrew it by 3 miles and made Urakami Cathedral Ground Zero. By the way, he was a 33-degree Mason, and Nagasaki had expelled the Freemasons in 1926. I think it was a little payback there. But Dionysi's book, Atomic Bomb Secrets, was so dynamite that I really felt I had to review that. But my point is this. We've got all this persecution of Christians, and in America, it's worse. It's better. We don't see the genocide, but we have the whole thing with 1963, when the Supreme Court ruled that both prayer and Bible reading were illegal and unconstitutional in public schools. And by the way, 5 of those 9 Supreme Court justices were Freemasons. And I personally believe that the Freemasons regard their blood oaths to the Brotherhood to exceed their oath to the Constitution. It's my own theory. But we see it today with the banning of nativity scenes, the gay wedding cake thing.
Which they lost, by the way.
Yeah. In the end, they lost with the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
The mocking of Christianity in Hollywood. It's less. But the persecution of Christians, I think we need to couple that with the persecution of the truth movement. You know, I'm on Twitter, and one day I noticed that overnight I lost 200 followers, and I thought, is it just me? But other people were saying, I lost 2,000 followers, and it turned out there was a Twitter purge. And this is the last winter. There was a Facebook purge. You know, a Syrian girl got kicked out, and all these truthers got kicked out all of a sudden. And then on YouTube, Richie Allen and Richie from Boston and even Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, all of their YouTube channels wiped out. Now, they got them back up eventually, but it's a progressive campaign of persecution against alt media. Look at Susan Lindauer, who was thrown in jail after she said that the government knew about 9/11 in advance. She was in the CIA. Look at Scott Bennett, who said he worked for Dove Zancon. He said, we're funding terrorism. They threw him in jail. You know, they both have their own radio shows, by the way. They're out of jail now, Scott Bennett and Susan Lindauer.
Yeah, we talk to them all the time. I haven't talked to Susan in a while.
Yeah, good lady. But she knew about 9/11 before it happened. She tried to warn people. She sat out. She was a second cousin of Andrew Card, who was George Bush's, chief of staff. She sat outside his house for hours in her car trying to warn him about 9/11. She knew it was coming. We did know about 9/11, and nobody would pay attention because, as you know, there are people who wanted it to happen.
Of course.
But when you look at the persecution of the truth movement and the persecution of Christianity, I was talking to the Bolsheviks and the Armenian genocide and Nagasaki before. When you see that they persecute Christians and the truth movement, and it's the same Luciferian powers that be, that's another indicator that we should be on the same page, that as Christians and truthers, they should be coming together and they should be united instead of divided.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, it's almost as though the state of the church in this country, someone is thinking there's a contradiction between the behavior of the church as a whole and the truth movement. It's almost as though, I know the components, the truth movement, the exposure of things like what happened, everything from the Maine to the Lusitania to Pearl Harbor to the Gulf of Tonkin to the World Trade Center buildings. I know that's what we're trying to reveal, the truth of those matters,
mm-hmm.
as well as the outrageous control that these huge family-owned banks have and have had for centuries. Does it seem to you in any way that each of these houses, the church and the truth movement, the truth movement is about society and human things? The church is about humans and spiritual things. Can they be combined, or do each of them need to get their respective stuff together? And then if there is a coalescence, fine. But otherwise, the government needs to be straightened out, whether you're a hardcore Christian or you're an atheist. You still live in the country and you're still a citizen. You still have the power of the vote. So should we have separation of truth movement and church? Isn't that state and church, frankly?
Yeah, I think that there should be state and church. And originally there was, you know, beginning with Constantine, there was actually it was unified church and state, and the emperors and the kings, they became defenders of the faith. And my own belief is that the New World Order, Illuminati, Rothschild led, if you will, the Rothschilds knew that if you wanted to attack the church, you had to get rid of the defender of the church. And the defender of the church was the monarch, be he the Austro-Hungarian emperor, the czar, or one of the many European kings. And so their goal became over the years to overthrow all of the monarchies, which they stood in the way of their ultimate target, which was the church. And so I think there always was a harmony between church and state. And I think one of the reasons why theologians, like clergymen, pastors, and priests, aren't better informed is that traditionally their role was strictly spiritual. They were to look after the souls, and the state was to look after their bodies. But today there's no monarch protecting the church anymore. The czar is gone. The kings are gone. You know, they've still got the royal family in England, but they've been compromised. You know, the ones they couldn't compromise, they got rid of. The Rothschilds knew they could never intermarry into our hereditary monarchy. So the best way to get rid of it is to overthrow it with your Freemasons and your revolutionaries. And they overthrew them one by one and replaced it with democracies, which they knew they could control democracies, because all you got to do is get 51% of the vote. And when you own the newspapers, your candidate is guaranteed to get 51% of the vote. And that's kind of the way they've done it over the centuries. But yeah, I think that the one reason why clergymen are not better informed on political matters is that there was a time when they never had to concern themselves with political matters, because the state took care of that. The monarch, the defender of the faith, who was a Christian in most cases, and of course there were good and bad amongst them, but as defenders of the faith, their job was to look after things politically. So a clergyman didn't have to bother himself with political matters, and that's one reason why they have a void there now.
You know, the thing that is a little bit, it makes things difficult is that in the case of President Trump, we have a guy who has a deep conviction where his spirituality is concerned. He believes in God, and that's obvious. He believes in prayer. He believes in all those things. I think he's Catholic. Is Mr. Trump Catholic? I think so.
This I don't know.
But look how they come after him. Because they, the ones on the left, the Marxists, the lunatics, they think that every Christian thinks of themselves as a perfect person. I mean, you have only to talk to them for a few minutes to confirm what would otherwise be just a wild speculation. But they think that if a person identifies themselves as a Christian, then that means somehow they're spiritually more evolved, therefore they are better in some way, therefore they are unequal. I've said this several times. I'm going to say it over and over again. Freedom is the right to be unequal. Mm-hmm. Equality is the requirement to be exactly the same. So these people who have this equality thing in mind, these leftists, think that if you're Christian, you're better than they are. You're better than somebody. Some obscure person out there is being thought of by someone as being less than them. That's a problem. You know, people just basically don't know what they're talking about. They think they know, but they don't. And therefore, they think they know what they're talking about, and they don't. So, because Mr. Trump has spoken about prayer and pray for the country and pray for this and our thoughts and prayers and heartfelt condolences, whatever, this really annoys the left. And so, oh, you've got CNN hosts declaring states of emergency and all this nonsense, these idiot journalists out there. I'm using the word idiot journalist. Oh, he's a rapist, he's a misogynist, he's a Nazi, this and that. Well, he's none of those things, but it's okay for them to say it. Why? Because they perceive that he's not mutual. This is that Patrick McGoohan thing, James, from The Prisoner. That's very unmutual of you. And they'll take you to a mental hospital, and when they finish with you, you'll be mutual, all right. You'll be everybody else that went to the mental hospital and got zapped. You know, this seems on the surface to be a harmless enough, a somewhat interesting, somewhat benign yet interesting subject. Got the words out of order. But this is serious, because if there's a perceived crossover between the truth movement and Christianity, then I think the first order of business is tighten up on our Christianity, and the truth movement will take care of itself. You agree?
If Christianity gets its act together, then the truth movement will take care of itself.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, because if the church gets its part together, then there's a lot of infighting. Not a lot, but some infighting.
Oh, there's been infighting for centuries, absolutely. That's part of the problem. That's the division, the schismatics.
No, you finish, because we're talking over each other. It's that Fox News thing. I hate it when that happens. Say your part.
Infighting was sort of what I was sort of going in the direction of before, was that we've got this constant splintering, this constant disagreement amongst people who have their own opinions about how a church should be run, and then they form their own church. And I've seen that happen. I've seen churches where somebody disagrees with the pastor or the elder board, and they go off and they form their own church. And this process has been going on for centuries, and that's one reason why Christianity is in its state today. Now, if Christianity was to return to its original form, what impact would that have on the truth movement? I don't know, except probably you'd see more truthers migrating into it. And I would expect that if churches became less seeker-sensitive, less Joel Osteen-like, and materialistic in some of them, abandoning Christian Zionism, that would be a huge one, then definitely you would see more Christians showing an appreciation for the realities, for example, of the Middle East. So you're right. There would be some upgrade in the truth movement and some more Christians becoming part of it. If the Christians dumped their Scofield reference Bibles and a lot of their theological teachings and a lot of the modernism that has been impressed upon them, and got their act together and saw the faith as in the light that it should be seen. Probably didn't say that exactly right, but that's more or less what I intended to say.
I get you. And you know what I was referring to, because it's perfect what you said, and I can put the other part to it, is that there is some, not necessarily infighting, but there's argument within the truth movement in some
area. Oh, sure, and some of that's deliberate, no question.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of these people are agitators who have come in, and they're just causing problems and discord.
Right. Others
are just like in politics and in the church. Some of them are slightly insane, if not profoundly neurotic. Maybe some. Not many, but some. And they're noisy until people get sick of it and something happens. They go, okay, you're blocked, or whatever they do. But here's the thing. I'm thinking that if the church gets its stuff together first, then people will conduct themselves in a truthful manner. They will maintain their integrity. They will be respectable, meaning they will conduct themselves in a manner that makes them worthy of being respected by others. And so, if that's the case, then their investigations will have the same level of integrity, hopefully, or they'll just say, we can't proceed any farther with our investigations. We've gone as far as we can. This much we know to be true, but this is as far as we've gone, whatever it is. So I'm not sure that I think they are partially compatible. But I think the church has got a bigger problem than the truth movement does. Because the detractors of the truth movement are so visible. But the people who work behind the scenes to slightly skew church doctrine this way or that, that's more insidious. It takes longer, and I think it's less visible. You can tell when somebody just – my jury's out on QAnon right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the original QAnon is actually on the other side of the other side of the sod, okay? Not the sunny side, the dark side of the sod. And if somebody has taken over, I don't know. I don't know if it was. I mean, the way you hook people, James, is you give them a good bit of truth and then start feeding the other side.
Oh, best way, absolutely. You know, like with a old KGB defector, give them 90% truth and then give them the 10% lie that is what you were sent over from the East in the first place to plant.
Yeah, the 10%
in their mind, you know. That's definitely true. Well, you bring up some cogent points, and I think part of it goes back to what you're saying earlier about how some people think Christians talk down to them. So I think you're right that if the church and people behave with more integrity and interacted in a less judgmental way, that would help to communicate better when they were in the truth movement, for sure. And
well, you know, it might not even be that, James. It might be just that, my opinion is the ones on the left, the hardcore, it is such anathema to them. Christianity is such anathema to the Marxist mentality that it's an easy thing to believe, to make themselves believe and to make others of their ilk believe that these people look down or talk down to them when they don't.
Right. Sure, there's a lot of misperception. I mean, these people have a pretty skewed view of the world, and so they're going to often have a skewed view of people who are talking to them and take it in the wrong way, regardless of maybe how politely you couch your views.
Now, when people go to jamesperloff.com, what do they get?
Okay, they get a lot of blog posts that deal with both current events and history. So I cover a lot of flag events. You'll find links to Spanish-American War there, major ones on Pearl Harbor, the Lusitania. I've had 5 blog posts on 9/11 now, and I've had to keep refining my views because, you know, I get contacted by pilots who tell me revise my views on this and that. And I've finally decided that the best thing to do is to write a book on 9/11. As much as there are books out there, I have been contacted with people and expertise on nuclear weapons and a number of pilots with great expertise on 757s and 767s. And I think that at this point, this book would have enough novel things to bring to the 9/11 picture that I should publish it. So that's what I'm working on right now. But on the website, they'll see a lot of my embedded videos that I've done, interviews I've done, like the one we're having tonight, and a great many blog posts on history. One of the most recent popular ones was called A Syrian Christian Reveals What's Really Happening in Syria. It had over 6,000 Facebook shares in the first 3 weeks, which for my website is a lot of Facebook shares. And for some reason, that hit with a hotspot for a lot of people. And that we actually did that interview a week before the alleged Duma chemical weapons attack and then the subsequent bombing. So that became kind of I think there was a trigger for some of the reaction that that article got. But this woman was also a very devout Orthodox Christian, and I know her personally. But she's also a Syrian with many, many family and friends in Syria, and that got a big response. But I also did one recently on the golden age of television and why that took place. And, you know, again, went on the Battle of Lexington. I think I'm the only person who's ever vetted the Battle of Lexington as a false flag. The 1775 battle, the British were actually deceived into firing first. by men who were hiding in the bushes who fired and made sure they didn't hit any British soldiers, but made sure that the British thought that somebody was shooting at them to get them to fire first in order to fulfill Sam Adams' pledge to the Continental Congress. They would only ask for assistance from the other colonies if an incident occurred where the British fired first. It's quite a complex story. But most of the American Revolution happened right here in Massachusetts, with the Battle of Lexington, the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Massacre. It all happened here. This is where the Freemasons, I'm going to say it frankly, the Freemasons plotted all this stuff and got that conflict going to bring about an age where there'd be no monarchs and only this New World Order that we see accomplishing about today. As many as good things have happened in America since then. Because I just don't want to not acknowledge that. Like I say, I just published a post on 9/11 just a few days ago on what struck the Twin Towers, because that was the thing that was hanging me up for a long time, was what struck the Twin Towers. That really had me hung up. You know, there was the impossible physics of the plane hitting it, but if it was a missile, how do we account for the airliner debris? And it was like, it's like no matter what position you took, there seemed to be contradictions, and I think we finally came across a solution that resolved it for all of them. But I'm going to be proceeding with a book on 9/11. And my basic thesis is that this was I've stated this before, that I don't believe that 9/11 was an inside job in the classic sense that we consider an inside job. I think it was an inside job in the sense that there were high-level people like Dov Zakheim and Dick Cheney who were involved. But at the hands-on operational level, 9/11 was an Israeli job. Whether we're talking about the nukes in the basement of the Twin Towers that ultimately demolished them, the actual hijackings of the plane, which I do believe did occur by Israeli special ops, the Sayeret Matkal would be the obvious choice for a job like this. And as well as I found out from Chris Bolin that the Israelis had manufacturing plants here in the United States that converted jetliners into tankers and other types of aircraft that modified airplanes and could also created remote control drone aircraft right here in the United States. The Israelis were doing that. And I think that at the hands-on operational level, it's you could compare it to the attack on USS Liberty. It's certainly true with the USS Liberty in 1967 that our Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and our President Lyndon Baines Johnson cooperated with that attack. They recalled the fighters who were sent to rescue the Liberty from the attack, and they ordered a cover-up afterwards. But at the hands-on level, it wasn't American military attacking the USS Liberty. It was the Israelis. And I believe that's what happened on 9/11. And that's why it was dancing Israelis that were caught, not dancing CIA agents, not dancing Lockheed engineers, or dancing Navy SEALs. It was the Israelis on 9/11. And I think that if you go to there's a blog post on the WikiSpooks website called 9/11 Israel Did It, you'll have a hard time reading Israel's connections to 9/11 and not understanding how much of an Israeli event that was. I should mention, as just an example, Benjamin Netanyahu was such good friends with Larry Silverstein that he called him on the phone every week. In the weeks leading up to 9/11, every week he would talk to Larry Silverstein. It'd be Netanyahu calling Silverstein, not the other way around. And as you know, Silverstein became owner less than 2 months before the attacks. He got a $5 billion payout on almost $5 billion on an investment of $124 million. And he conveniently, him and his family, happened to miss being at the World Trade Center that morning. And he was, of course, with the guy who said to pull it on Building 7. And the Israeli connections just go on and on. It was Benjamin Netanyahu himself in his 1995 book, Fighting Terrorism, that predicted a nuclear bomb will be placed in the basement of the World Trade Center. 1995, 6 years before the event. So, but you just go on. The Israeli connections are amazing. And again, I would go to that website, WikiSpook's article, 9/11 Israel Did It, or to my five articles on 9/11. And that's not something I ever thought I would write about because so many people have done it. But because people contacted me who had expertise in certain things like flight and nuclear weapons, I went ahead with information they had given me to nuclear, in the hopes of pushing the reconstruction of that day closer to accuracy.
Well, I misunderstood you earlier. because I thought that, you had a book, like maybe a thick book.
It's coming out. It'll come out, but I'm working.
So you just released a few chapters.
Well, I released 5 articles, and because, John, I had to keep revising my my outlook on what the outcome was or how something was done. So if you go through my articles, there'll be some confusion because later you'll see in the next article I'll revise something. And so I felt that to bring everything up to date, it should be put in book form or something that would tie everything together in the most rational and easily absorbed way possible.
Understood. So I can't let you go now for a couple of minutes. Nuclear weapon in the basement of the World Trade Center.
The nukes were in the basement of the World Trade Center, and that is what accounts for the damage to the other buildings. You know, all the other buildings got crated out or on fire. Building 7 was on fire. There were flames there. Where did those flames come from? Barry Jennings, who was the emergency coordinator, said he was going down the stairs. He was emergency coordinator for the New York Housing Authority. He said he was going down the stairs of Building 7 with a colleague, and there was an explosion from the bottom up that tore out the stairwell beneath them. Where did that explosion come from? It came from the secondary effects of the nukes in the World Trade Center, because unknown to most people, the entire World Trade Center was connected underground. So by a 3-foot wide drainage system. And when the nukes went off in with the service pits of elevator 50, the only elevator that went the entire length of either tower, when it went off in those service pits, which is the only area the World Trade Center was carved in the bedrock beneath the World Trade Center, which made it the perfect launching point for a nuke because the bedrock contained the sideways and downward force of the nuke. This is what I got from the nuclear experts. It also went through the pipes, the drainage pipes that led to the underground drainage system. And so you had an upward explosion in buildings 4, 5, 6, and 7, creating the cratering out and the fires. That's why those buildings didn't fall down like the Twin Towers, because they were getting secondary nuclear explosion. You can see evidence for it. When the first building falls down, the South Tower, you'll see that there are geysers springing up from the ground. That is the underground drainage system. The secondary effect of the blast is going through it and bursting. And first you see water vapor, and then it turns to smoke. And that is what happened. It was definitely a nuclear event that brought the Twin Towers down. That is not to deny use of previous explosions prior to the demolition, but that 10-second demolition where the towers are just wiped out, that's a small nuclear device. We probably shouldn't have gone down this trail. I'm probably raising a lot more questions than answers at this point. I'm sure I am. But that's in my articles. My articles are...
I said, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor.
Yeah, you're what kind of doctor? Bless. Forgive me for not knowing.
Bro, what I'm trying to say is, you know, that Star Trek thing, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, you know?
Okay. Come on, man. Okay. I didn't watch Star Trek. I never was into sci-fi.
All right. Now, if you're going to come on with me and we're going to talk about nuclear devices going off just for a second, we're supposed to talk about Christianity and the Truth Movement. You see how clever I can be in getting you off onto this.
Well, I may come back in September. We'll see. You may make a decision right now.
Well, here's the thing, James, seriously. Why the powder from the top down? I must know. What is the deal with the powder from the top down? Powder.
Okay, we're talking about the most powerful explosive known to man, okay? And we're talking about an explosion that doesn't go boom and it's over in a second. Watch a nuclear test. The nuke keeps on giving. It keeps on exploding. And it has more explosive force than any other explosive device known to man. It can do that. Look at Hiroshima. It was turned to dust, too. It's the same thing. It's the nuclear effect. And those are Israeli suitcase nukes. Those are suitcase nukes. You can carry them in a backpack. That's how easy it is to carry them into the World Trade Center, especially when you've got Larry Silverstein, Benjamin Netanyahu's good friend, taking over the World Trade Center. You don't need to put explosives at every level. But again, I'm ticking a lot of people off because I know that the Truth Movement is very diverse in its views. I know about nanothermite. I know about the directed energy weapons, et cetera. And there's a lot of views out there. And I have, you know, I have friends who hold to those views, good friends who I hang out with who hold to those same theories, and it doesn't get in the way of our friendship. But it was because I was contacted by nuclear experts that I came to this he point, you know, the nuclear experts pointed out the thyroid cancer rates in the first responders, the type of cancer that first responders get more than any other cancer, and in relation to its expected rate is thyroid cancer. That's a signature of an atomic bomb. The only known cause of thyroid cancer is a nuclear device. Or you look at the nuclear fission products in the dust of the World Trade Center, which the only explanation that could be for that uranium and thorium is a nuclear device. You can't get away from it. But I'm not denying the use of other types of advanced weapons on 9/11. I'm just saying that big boom, when the, what's the North Tower? What's the North? People tend to watch the South Tower, which has the clack, 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 where they came up with the pancaking theory. What's the North Tower, the second tower to explode? You will see a massive flame inside the building. There is one massive flame. Watch it on video. It's all over YouTube. You'll see a massive flame. That is the nuke going off, bringing the tower down. And it went, and it didn't fall. It exploded. That tower exploded. And there were pieces that weighed multiple tons that flew hundreds of feet and embedded themselves in buildings across the street. That was a powerful explosion.
Well, yeah. And weren't there reports early on of momentary increases in nuclear radiation, ionizing radiation readings?
Yes, I've heard that. And But some of the factors that reduced the radiation were the fact that you have a high fusion bombs, bombs that are called high fusion, low fission. If you have lots of fusion, which is the putting together of nuclear particles, as opposed to fission, which is the breaking apart of nuclear particles, that's the type of bombs we had at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Those type of bombs will create lots of radiation. But if it's high in fusion, that nuke tends to be more clean and lets off much less radiation. Of course, the Israelis, what kind of bombs do they want? They want high fusion bombs, bombs with low radiation, because if they get into a nuclear war with their neighbors like Iran, they don't want radiation blowback coming to Tel Aviv. They want low radiation bombs, and that's the type they would probably stockpile. We don't know because they keep their nukes an ironclad secret. But that's one of the reasons you would see low radiation. The other factor is that when a nuke goes off underground, we know this from our own nuclear tests, it greatly decreases the amount of radiation. There was one bomb that the U.S. set off. I'm trying to think of the name of it. I want to say the Ceylon bomb is not quite it. But one of our nukes, we set it off in an underground mine. It reduced the radiation by 94%. So setting off the bomb in the very deepest part of the World Trade Center, which had six basement levels, by the way, we're talking about the bottom, very bottom of the World Trade Center, that would also reduce the amount of radiation you would experience, together with the fact that it rained afterwards and they piled a lot of dirt under the fires afterwards. All were factors that would reduce the amount of radiation taking place.
I've said it many times, or asked the question many times, do we think they may have improved those weapons since the World War II days?
You can be sure. You know, Dr. Edward Teller said that someday we'll have a completely clean nuke, no radiation at all. I don't think they ever reached that point, but they do have now what they call minimal residual radiation nukes, MRRs, minimal radiation left over, and that's probably what we saw at the World Trade Center. They weren't really interested in covering New York City with radiation. What they did want to do was to create this dramatic event that would push us towards war.
What does it tell us that people are willing to do this?
Well, we talked at the start, if you want to try this together a little bit, we talked about at the start about satanic rituals. David Dionisi pointed out that in the ancient satanic rituals, they used to burn sacrifice people in the fire to the god Moloch, because they thought that the Satanists thought they drew power from the death of the individual. Imagine how much more power you get from blowing up Dresden and hundreds of thousands of people set on fire, or Nagasaki, Hiroshima, or the World Trade Center. Some people think that there was a Luciferian sacrifice involved in this that goes beyond, because, you know, those people were vaporized inside those twin towers. They were literally vaporized. No whole bodies were found except from people who jumped. There are no whole bodies found from people who were inside the twin towers. They were literally vaporized, and the heat was enormous. You know, the fires burned for more than 3 months afterwards at ground level.
Wasn't there something curious about the way that all that debris was taken away?
Well, they certainly they trucked out thousands upon thousands of trucks came in to haul away the steel, and it was sold to China at $120 a ton. So they didn't waste much time in getting rid of the crime scene.
Well, I wonder if the Chinese got a good deal on that.
I'd say at $120 a ton, I'd say that's a good deal for just about anything.
$120 per ton. Wow, that's really something. You know, before you go, I want to leave people with some more knowledge about James Perlow. And that is, you said your own experiments with nuclear things. How much experimenting did you do?
Oh, no. I didn't mean my own experience. I was contacted by people who were quite expert in nuclear weapons who told me about the thyroid cancer rates, the seismograph readings, and the other evidence. And then I picked up from Susan Lindauer that she knew that they were going to use mini nukes. She talked about that long before I ever wrote this.
Oh.
And Netanyahu himself was on the air 2 days after 9/11 bragging to Tom Brokaw about how he predicted in his book, Fighting Terrorism, that there would be nuclear weapons in the basement of the World Trade Center. You know, he's right on the air bragging about it right in front of our eyes, and nobody knew. But it's because I've been contacted by people who are experts in aviation and nuclear weapons that I advanced these articles. Without it, I wouldn't have done it. But then my own theory, I came up with my own theory about the hijackings. I do believe that there were real hijackings. And one thing that affirmed that for me, you know, I've had this idea in the truth movement for a long time that the planes were electronically hijacked, because we know that the Hani Hanjour and the alleged hijackers, number one, they'd never been in a Boeing cockpit before in their lives. They were lousy pilots, and there's no way they can make direct hits at over 500 miles an hour on the Pentagon, the Twin Towers, because even Boeing pilots on simulators have, pilots of 9/11 truth have talked about this. Boeing pilots with thousands of hours of experience tried hitting the Twin Towers on 737 simulators. You know, the 737 is pretty small compared to a 767. They couldn't hit it at the alleged speeds. You have all kinds of G-forces on the wings. They couldn't do it. And, but what I realized was that, after people discovered that the hijackers, half of them were still alive, and that they couldn't have flown those planes, they decided, okay, no hijackers. So they started going electronic hijacking. And there was actually a TV show called The Lone Gunman, and it had its pilot episode in March of 2001. It showed a plane being electronically hijacked and flown into the world. Well, it didn't hit the World Trade Center. The heroes saved it at the last second. But 1 month after 9/11, a guy named Joe Viels came out with an article. He said that the 9/11 planes were electronically hijacked. This pilot, who I exchanged emails with, I call him Pilot A, he gave me so much great information about aviation that I published as an article called Conversations with a Pilot About 9/11. He completely ruled out electronic hijacking in 9/11. A 757 or a 767, you know, everything about flight on those planes, the ailerons, the rudder, the elevators, they're all controlled by cables and pulleys to pedals and yokes in the, it's all physical in the cockpit. You cannot hijack something that's not computer run. Now, a modern fly-by-wire computer-driven plane like a 777, you could hack into that, but not those planes on 9/11. I asked him about the autopilot, and he pointed out that the autopilot can only send you to a general latitude and longitude, a general location. There's no way you can set an autopilot to hit the World Trade Center at 208 feet wide, or the Pentagon, right, a bullseye hit on the first floor. You can't do it. Well, and even if they did hack into the autopilot, all you got to do is switch the autopilot off manually. Piece of cake. No, they had real hijackers on those planes, but they were special ops. They knew how to kill the pilots. We heard this dozens of times, and they had keys to the cockpit, we believe, from Al Al. They had people right in the front row. They stood up. They got right into the cockpit. They'd have to break down the door. They'd have to threaten them. They just got in the cockpit, killed the pilots instantly, which they were trained to do, probably with something like an EpiPen injector, took the pilots out of the seat. The pilots in back who were distracting the hostesses, the stewardesses, the flight attendants, while this was happening, now rush into the cockpit. You've got five guys in the pilot. And these guys know how to fly Boeings, but they're not on a suicide mission. They turn off the transponders. The planes disappear. except on radar. Now you've got your drones, which come up and take their place. The drones, which are remote controlled, are what hit your World Trade Center and your Pentagon. That's what I firmly believe at this point. Always open to revising my views. I've revised my views on this many times, but that's where I'm at this point, and that's what I'll be trying to bring out in this book.
It is odd that an engine that, I mean, but this is what I was talking about, people being inside the truth movement that may not be all that truthful. What about the engine that was discovered that didn't even belong on any of the planes that actually struck the towers, if they did, which some people say they didn't. Some people say they're drones. Some people say they're holograms. I still want to know who took the, who was rolling the camera right up there the moment that the 757 swooped in and hit the building. One we've all seen where it's kind of in a, it's in a turn, like an easy, a low angle turn. And it just goes zoom right into the side of the building. Who was operating the camera that day? Why was it pointed at that building? No one has ever
said. You're talking about the first one, the Nade Brothers film of the first tower?
Yeah, it just goes zoom right into the side of it. Not the one that went wafting in, and we're looking at it from about, I don't know, 2 miles away or something. That goes, bleh. I'm talking about the first one that just went zoom and just cut a slice into the
I don't know if the Nade brothers were hired or not, or if they just happened to catch it. It's the only film that we have available. Some people say that George Bush, you know, had his own personal view of it. But you're right, only the Nade brothers. In both those, if you look at the holes, the gashes in the Twin Towers, they're both at the exact same angle,
yeah,
or almost at the exact same angle. And both planes, just at the last moment, they swerved a little bit so that they could enter at a slight angle, which made sure that they would completely enter the building with no none of the wings being sheared off and flying to some other part of New York City. It clearly was well controlled.
So if they weren't hacked remotely, then how the fancy flying?
Well, I believe that it was, they were definitely were computer run, but just they weren't the original planes. What I'm saying is you can't hack those original planes. I believe these are special drones. You could certainly take a 767 and make it fly by wire, make it remote controlled, make it into a drone, harden its nose with titanium. I'm sure you've seen the pictures of the pod that's underneath flight 175 that hit the second tower. You can see it, yeah. it lights up before it hits the tower. You couldn't leave Logan Airport with that thing on there. You know, not only would the maintenance crew notice it, but it's mandatory for a captain to do a walk around of his plane before he takes off. No way you take off with something the size of a missile underneath your plane. You say, I'm not getting out of here. I'm not taking this plane off. That's not the same plane. That's a different plane that's hitting the tower. It's for sure. Like I say, no plane part on any of the four sites, not a single one, has ever been matched by serial number. And they keep records of those serial numbers. It's a unique serial number. And they keep logbooks on those serial numbers. You could easily find out what planes those parts came from. But they've never dared to match a single part to any of the original planes. So I'm not saying that. So when I say that the original planes weren't remotely hijacked, I'm saying that the original planes that took off were real hijackers, but they weren't electronically hijacked. But what actually flew into the second building or any of these targets, I believe, yes, they're definitely in electronic control. No question about that.
Gotcha.
We're definitely on the same page there. Yeah. Right, this is kind of elaborate to try to explain. We're talking about something that's been vetted and disagreed upon and within the truth movement in so many ways, and I'm coming at you kind of like from a perspective of where I'm at right now, but there's a whole bunch of information where I've had to change my mind several times over on some of these subjects in order to reach the conclusion that I have right now. Very hard to do in a concise conversation, but I enjoy talking with you about it. I realize this is almost like a second show. And I realize we may not end up broadcasting this. We may come back and depending on how you feel about it, we might come back and do a second show on 9/11.
Not at all, bro. Not at all. Because to me, this is probably the second thing. I'm just guessing right now, but I'm thinking the first thing that kicked off the truth movement was the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure 9/11 was the second one.
Yeah. 9/11 for sure, especially when you combine 9/11 with the internet. It just exploded. Alt media just exploded after that. No question about that.
Well, you know, there can be no doubt the thing was hinky. That BBC thing with Building 7's down, it's like, no, it's still standing there. Oop, we've lost the transmission. Oh, an hour later, we get it back. Yeah, it's down now. I mean, Building 7 has fallen. How stupid. So yeah. Clearly.
And, you know, within an hour, they're already blaming on Osama bin Laden. They already had the whole thing figured out. They already were talking about the buildings pancaking, and the whole thing was being explained by CNN, just the way the government explained it later. So it was definitely very well-arranged, I call it not just the crime of the century, but probably the crime of the millennium. Tremendous planning went into this, and tremendous money was spent preparing for this day.
Well, look, I'm eventually we will find out. We'll find out. I'm thinking there's a high percentage chance in the mid 90s that we will find out the names of all those involved at some point. There may be a couple of exceptions. Hopefully it won't be the most important people who were involved that will remain obscured for all time. But, you know, nothing is hidden that will not be revealed. It's written in scripture, and so it is.
Well,
and
the books will be open on the
where to look. And also, you need to remember that the truth may not come in the form that you planned it to come in. It may strike severely every sensibility and sensitivity you have. But if it's the truth, it's the truth. So I guess we'll just have to deal with it. I'm not going to say that the what your pilot friend said is rubbish. I'm not. But maybe. But that's why we have to check each other. And the thing is we've been too nice in handling these Marxists. We've been too nice with handling the New World Order. We've been too gullible. Letting them put all this weird stuff on the back of the dollar bill, and they don't bother to explain whatever any of it means, but they have the power. And you know, James, I still have yet to drive by a single Masonic lodge and see anybody there ever. I really don't understand it. I'm pretty sure people go there sometimes, but when you pass the same lodge every day, weekends too, and you never see anybody there.
Something, you know, what I heard, John, I heard that Freemasonry played a tremendous role in America until World War II. And then, you know, these guys would be involved in carrying out secret missions. Of course, they're sworn to secrecy. After World War II, we developed CIA, NSA, all these government taxpayer-funded agencies, and their need for Freemasonry was weakened. It's not that they don't still play a role, but today it's the NSA, CIA, these other spy agencies that have sort of taken over the secret endeavors that Freemasonry at one time have been involved with, the secret missions. They just aren't needed as much, so they're a little bit more window dressing, but I'm sure they still have their role, but just not as important as the one as they did pre-World War II.
Well, I certainly know what happened to one man who decided that he would go ahead and walk out of his 33rd degree induction because of the oath that he was required to take to finalize it. He wouldn't take it.
And this is someone you know personally?
Yeah, he's my father.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. You're actually my maternal grandfather, who died before I knew was a Freemason. And I have encountered Freemasons who have told me some pretty creepy satanic things, as well as Freemasons who deny that anything wrong happens. And they're telling the truth because within their particular lodges and their particular degree, nothing funky does happen. So nothing, you know, truly evil. So, you know, it's a complex group. But no question that they've played definitely a subordinate role in the New World Order.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you. Always do. And let's reconvene at a not too distant point in future, shall we? And you know, let us know how your investigations proceed, James. You're on your job. Lord knows you are. And you have the journalism background behind you. I mean, your bona fides are impeccable. Your CV is thick. And I wish you all the best and all the success in bringing this stuff to a head. It's going to be revealed sooner or later. And I think it was great to be able to talk about Christianity, the truth movement, and then a seminal moment in the creation of the truth movement, which was 9/11, how deceptive and all the different parties involved. And
yeah, there's so much that could be said about 9/11. And like I say, so many people have said it well. I think Chris Berlin is probably, I think he's probably the best researcher out there in terms of tying things together. I have been contacted, though, by people who have been able to show me things that were not known before. And because there are some things that are novel and some we have some outlooks that are not been heard before. I am working currently on a book on 9/11. Hope to have it out within a few months. Take some time, as you know.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to seeing it and reading it. And it'll be good to see you again when that happens. So we'll check in with you before it starts to get cold.
John, it's always great being on with you. You have a wonderful personality and a tremendous breadth of knowledge. It's just a delight to know you and have you as a friend as we speak online. Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
We're brothers in arms, our microphones and our cameras and our pens and our paper, those are our arms. We are brothers in arms. And I'll just say God bless and thanks so much for coming on. And we'll be in touch, all right? So stay safe and strong out there.
Okay, God bless you, John.
Thanks. James Perloff, everybody, you know. All right, this is where I come up on this. Christianity is the truth movement. And everything else follows. Treachery, betrayal, Armageddon, you know, the usual bill of fare here in conspiracy land. The fact is there are historians of the future. We interviewed him. And there are books of the future. It's not that you have to believe it before you see it, before you can see it. It's just that you have to be willing to see it so that you can see it, and then you'll believe it. Okay? And I say again, Christianity is the truth movement. And if what's happening, who's really running the world, what's really going on here, who's really in control? Well, go to your Bible. It spells it out very clearly. There is a force known as evil. I'm sorry to give you a rerun over and over and over again. So it's a rerun. But I say again, a rose by any other name smells just as sweet. And Satan by any other name is just as evil, is evil, personifies evil, is identified in Holy Scripture as the father of lies. Oh, that's a flowery thing. I know what we'll call him. We'll call him, I've got it, the father of lies. How about that? Nobody was trying to impress anybody with fanciful names when that scripture was written. He is the father of lies. So why wouldn't we be subjected to deception and attempts at deception every day of our lives? Why would we not? If we're having to deal in our human fallen state with the father of lies, who's always working to mess us over. So, can the truth movement and Christianity coexist? Certainly they can. Can they meld? Absolutely, positively. In fact, the more true Christianity in the so-called truth movement, in just meaning the discovery of these events that are caused in furtherance of harming human beings and destroying human beings and destroying everything that they hold as sacred and dear, so that the ones doing the destroying emerge as the leaders and the ones which are worshipped, the ones with all the power. If that's the sole objective, well, that pretty much sums the one they call Satan up. So, if the truth movement is infused with some true Christianity, I think we'll be able to get to the truth of these various incidents that have caused so much heartache and bloodshed. I think we'll get there a lot sooner. You can't take the truth out of the truth, and it does not require your belief in it to exist. That may offend some, and those who are offended by such a statement should examine, why does that offend me? You'll come to your conclusion pretty quickly. It's called vanity. Be seeing you.